I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Welcome to the CBS This Morning podcast. I'm Vladimir Dutis, CBS News correspondent. Today, very, very happy to be joined by Dr. David Agus. He is a leading cancer expert and a CBS News contributor. He is the head of the University of Southern California's Cancer Center. Good to see you, Dr. Agus.
Oh, great to see you, Vlad. Nice to be here.
So there's a lot to unravel here. And once again, I think for people, breast cancer hit home for a lot of people who may not have been directly affected by it when we saw a tweet from Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's a famous actress who most people of a certain age, my age, will know her from Seinfeld, but she's been, you know, doing film.
You're that
TV.
Old?
I'm that old. Yes, thanks for reminding me, though. And she, you know, I think in the tweet, I'm paraphrasing, she said, you know, like millions of others of other Americans who've suffered through breast cancer, I am now one of those millions of Americans. And we've seen that although breast cancer deaths are down almost 40% over the last three decades, it still is an issue. Let's talk about why it's down and why it still is a problem for so many people in this country and around the world.
Yeah, you know, still 250,000 cases a year, 40,000 deaths a year. At the same time, you know, the death is down, and it's mainly because we're screening better. We pick up cancers earlier, and this is one of those cancers that's clear the evidence that if you detect it early, it's much more curable. Mm. And then our treatments are better. So classically, for example, if you have a 1 centimeter cancer and you take it out, we offer patient therapy so it doesn't come back. And that therapy is getting better and better. And so we're good at that. At the same time, we're not good enough. And, you know, one of the things that really pulls at my heart is when we do stories of this and we talk about how rosy the cancer care is, and then there's that poor woman who's dying of breast cancer. And we have to be cognizant that we aren't good enough. We're still losing 40,000 people a year. So I'm encouraged, but we have to get better.
So is it fair to say, as a layman, that there are certain rankings of cancers? In other words, this particular cancer, breast cancer, is, I don't want to use the word, you know, it seems as if you're saying that if you detect it early enough, the chances of survival are
better.
Tremendous. Then, for example, I've heard, you know, melanoma or, you know,
pancreatic
Peter Jennings,
cancer, right.
he died very quickly from lung cancer, I believe, right? He announced it, and then within 6 or 8 months, he was gone. So are there rankings of these different cancers?
You know, we don't rank them. We don't go in a closed room and, you know, try to rank the cancers. But what we do know is that some are controllable. You know, in 1997, there was a 25-year-old kid who had germ cell tumor in the brain, the lung, and the liver. And he went to some of the great cancer doctors in the country. And they all said, you know, chemotherapy is going to make you sick. You know, just spend your last couple months with your mother, because he was son of a single mother. And this kid heard about an experiment where a doctor put 2 platinum electrodes in a gel and said, do cancer cells like electricity or not? Well, they didn't care about the electricity, but some of the platinum leached off and killed some of the cells. So he was given it intravenously. A year and a half later, he won his first of 7 Tours de France. So that was Lance Armstrong. So Lance had a cancer that at the time was incurable and now is curable. So with progress, with new drugs, we're dramatically changing the playing field. One of the most aggressive subtypes of breast cancer, for example, was one that was driven by a gene called HER2. When a lot of copies of that gene happen, it gets driven. That was one of the most aggressive. Now it's one of the most controllable because we have the ability of targeting that gene and turn it off by several drugs that are on the market. Mm. So the field is changing, but there still are some aggressive phenotypes. There's one called triple negative, which means it doesn't have estrogen receptors or progesterone receptors or this HER2. And so there's not as much to target. And that's a much harder subtype of breast cancer to treat.
So we understand that it's the most commonly diagnosed cancer in women, breast cancer is. But in recent
second
years—
Second to skin cancer. So the skin cancers, the basal cells, which again aren't deadly, most of them, is more common, but obviously less deadly.
Less deadly. But there's been a debate lately around over diagnosing individual patients and over-treatment. Is there any validity to that?
You know, the dirty secret for what I do as a cancer doctor is that there's no right answer for anything.
I mean, what is over-diagnosing? I don't know what that even really
means. So what it means is that maybe we don't need to treat all the cancers. There's something called ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a precancerous condition. So if we see it, we end up going surgery to take it out, but not all of them need to have that. And at the same time, by screening, not all the tests that we think are positive turn out to be a cancer, and we call that a false positive. So if you have a mammogram, we see a little spot, there's a calcification, you end up going a surgical procedure, and there was nothing there. There was no cancer there. That's a false positive. So the test isn't perfect. You know, mammograms, you know, comes from x-rays, which are literally 100 years old, so we have to get better at screening, but it works. And there's a lot of debate out there. There's noise. The noise is, do we start at age 40 or 45 or 50? Do we do it once every year, 2 years? Nobody will debate that mammograms work. That's clear. The real challenge is how to do the nuances, when exactly to do it, how often to do it, and that debate will happen, but people shouldn't pay attention. Get your family risk, know how high you are on the risk chain, and based on that, we'll tell you when to get your mammogram.
This is going to sound like a weird question, but just based on what you said, I'm just going to jump on that. If you, for people who may not know their family history, adopted people, for example, how can you as a doctor know if I'm at risk for any type of cancer if I don't know my family history?
So there are a couple answers to that question. The first, it's a great question. The first is genetic, right? When Angelina Jolie, you know, heroically said, I have the gene for breast cancer, it was thousands of dollars to do the test. Now, for $99, one can get the test to look for the genetic marker called BRCA1 or BRCA2 in breast cancer.
$99. Somebody, you know, you don't need health insurance if you don't.
This is out of pocket, $99. And wow. It's a remarkable empowering. You know, all of a sudden, there's no ransom for a woman to look at her own DNA because the Supreme Court of the United States said you can no longer patent a gene in our country. So it wasn't one company with that test. Now it's been democratized.
Wow.
There are other risk factors, though, for breast cancer that put you at higher risk other than family. It's being obese. It's being sedentary. It's not having children. It's taking hormone replacement therapy. All of those can slightly raise your risk. And so that goes into the risk profile of when to screen.
That's really fascinating. So you say that the mammograms are been around for 100 years. I actually didn't know that. That's fascinating. And it works. But why haven't we developed a better way to screen for this? I get it. It's simple. It works. We figured it out. Could it be that's why we're seeing sometimes some of those false positives?
No question about it. You know, I was got to go on a Navy ship once, and they were showing me on their radar a mile away. They could tell me exactly what kind of fish they saw. So you can imagine a mile away to identify a fish, yet we can't put a device right next to a breast and know what's in it. You know, very little resources in our country research-wise. The NIH and others go to technology development. The dominant ones actually go to develop treatments for people with the disease. And I get that, but we have to start to shift resources and get better at diagnosing things. And so whether it be a blood test to know it's there or better imaging technologies, that has to come. And we have to incentivize people to take the risk to do those studies.
And you mentioned some of the characteristics, the attributes, the predispositions that exist for women when it comes to screening for cancer. What can women do to lower their risk? I mean, you could say, look, you shouldn't be obese, but that's the advice for no matter what, right? We should be healthy individuals by not being obese because we are at risk for diabetes and a whole bunch of other ailments. What else can women do to lower their risk?
Our bodies were designed to move. So just walking and moving will lower one's risk. You know, that debate of do you take estrogen replacement therapy or not after menopause is one that impacts breast cancer risk. But there are drugs. There are generic drugs, tamoxifen and raloxifene. So two drugs that hit that estrogen receptor that dramatically lower the risk of breast cancer in women. So about a 70% reduction by taking one of these pills. We can do that. There are side effects to drugs, no question about it. Remember, there's another pill that if you take it, reduces the incidence of breast cancer by another probably 40% called a baby aspirin. So there are pharmacologic ways, there are behavior ways, and obviously it's screening. Is that every woman needs to, the same time of the month in their menstrual cycle, do a breast exam and feel. Feeling those abnormalities early make all the difference in the world.
If you are predisposed to breast cancer, it's no longer a death sentence. Is it fair to say that?
You know, Angelina Jolie is, you know, it's amazing her transparency and, you know, how she just told her personal story and intimate details to the country. But she had bilateral mastectomies with reconstruction. So in today's world, the plastic surgery is amazing on the reconstruction, but she took off, which gave her a 98, 99% reduction. There's always a little bit of breast tissue left behind, but makes it very unlikely of getting that breast cancer.
That's that is wonderful news. Let's talk about, you mentioned a couple of them, but for the consumers out there who, and just ordinary people who are interested in new treatments or studies,
right,
where can they look? What can they look to?
First of all, we're not consumers, we're people.
Right. I got to remember that sometimes.
And remember, it's not just women, it's men.
It's not Soylent Green either. We're not Soylent Green.
But it's men too. I mean, so I just want to make the point that men do get breast cancer also. But we have the standard treatments, which are the hormonal treatments, the chemotherapy. And then all of a sudden, over the last several years, we have two new avenues that are real excitement and give optimism when I walk in the room of a patient. The first is what we call molecularly targeted therapy. It sounds kind of Star Wars-ish, but they're real in the drugs on the market that we can sequence the DNA and identify an on switch and then target it with many times pills. And the other is what we call immunotherapy. Every cancer is born with a don't-eat-me signal. And these are drugs that block that don't-eat-me signal to allow your own immune system to attack the cancer. So these were considered science fiction a decade ago, and now they're commonplace in our treatment of this disease.
You know, it's interesting. Back before I became a reporter, I worked on Wall Street for a number of years, and I recall when the human genome was being mapped, there were a lot of companies that were launching around that phenomena. And I remember one of the roadshows, one of the doctors said to me, you know, once we've mapped the human genome, cancer will be a thing of the past, right? And I think a lot of people, myself included, looked to that future, but we have mapped the human genome, and yet it isn't. What is missing from what our understanding of the human genome, what that brought us with regards when it comes to cancer?
So if you're going to drive from New York to Boston, and you take apart a car and look at every piece of the car, it doesn't tell you how long it takes to get there. You forgot the weather, the traffic, the bladder size of the driver. So the genome is just taking apart the car. You know, an amazing study came out last year, which was really important, where they looked at the eyelid. It's the only part of your body that you don't classically put sunscreen on. And when they sequenced 100 people, they all had DNA changes of cancer, yet none of them had cancer. Because in order to get cancer, you need that DNA change, that mutation we call it, but you also need a receptive environment. To me, cancer is a verb and not a noun. You don't get cancer. It's something the body does. You're cancering. And so my job as a doctor going forward, the new era of medicine, will to change you from a state of disease to a state of health, not just putting poison in to target the cell. And I think that's going to be the new exciting frontier in cancers.
Before we wrap this up, I think what's interesting is, and we sort of painted a, I don't want to use the word rosy, but we've given optimism to a lot of people who may be worried about this. But and I'm looking at my notes here because I want to be really, really specific. White women are at a slightly higher risk of breast cancer, but the death risk between 2011 and 2015 was 42% higher in African American women. Why is that? Yeah.
So with these studies, we know association. So they have less screening, so less mammography. So clearly, less mammography, you catch cancers later. That they don't have as good health care and they're not in the system where some of these newer exciting drugs are being treated. And also there are cultural differences. There may be, and there is, clearly more obesity in the African-American women compared to Caucasian women right now in the country. And that's certainly a risk factor. And there may be a genetic component too, that the cancers themselves may be different. We're all different a little bit genetically. And the cancers themselves may be a little bit more aggressive in these African-American women. So this is important. These kind of observations are what lead to hypotheses that we can then test and study. But it clearly is a critical area. You know, I'm privileged to be on Joe Biden's cancer initiative.
Yeah.
And one of the big things that we're working on is trying to get a quality of care across the country. If you go to Sloan Kettering here in New York, you're going to get remarkable care in the state of the art. But we want that same thing to happen in any city in the country so everybody can have access to these drugs that were, most of them, by the way, developed with taxpayer dollars. So taxpayer dollars, universities identified these genes and these drugs, and we should all benefit.
And, you know, it's important. It almost sounds as if what you're suggesting in this particular incident is that part of it is economic, right? I mean, if you are living
it's education too.
And education,
so,
yeah.
You know, mammographies are accessible. I mean, one of the great things that the Affordable Act pushed for was screening for everybody being covered. And so we have to get out there, whether it be in the churches, whether it be in the schools, and we have to educate people that screening matters. And it's a pain in the butt or a pain in the breast to get a mammogram, literally. but we have to do it. And while we hope and we strive for better technologies, this is what we got now, and it works, so it has to be used.
And I wonder, again, I'm just riffing here off the top of my head, and you may not know the answer to this, but for example...
17 milligrams twice a day.
Done. Write me the prescription. Would we see... I guess if you had a population like, for example, in Nigeria, I was based in Nigeria mm-hmm. for a couple of years... you wouldn't see these differences, obviously, because the majority of the population there is of African descent. You would see numbers regardless of ethnicity or race in a more contained, is what the medical term, a contained setting or contained environment.
Right, but behavior is different. So it's not just race, it's behavior, yeah, right? They're skinnier. They exercise more. They walk more. Their diet is different.
They're not eating the same foods we are,
and,
right?
Right, yeah. And we all respond differently. You know, there's an amazing group, the Maasai Warriors.
Yeah, in Kenya.
And when you look, you know, they have almost no heart disease at all. But you look in autopsy, they do have atherosclerotic disease, but they just don't have heart attacks because they compensated. Their blood vessels get larger and other things. So they don't have that. And we've all developed ways as groups to compensate. And so what's interesting is studying each of them. And from each of them, we can learn something that will help the others. You know, what's amazing is, you know, the BRCA gene was identified in the Mormon population. And yet it's a discovery that's helped everybody literally in the world. And so studying each of these groups, the outliers, if you will, is going to give us clues to the central.
Are Icelanders an outlier? I read somewhere years ago that there is not as high of an incidence of cancers in the Icelandic population as there are in other populations of similarly group people. Is that still the case?
They were isolated. Iceland was isolated. So there was, you know, homogeneity. So they were actually a remarkable group to study, and they were studied genetically because they were all relatively similar. And they could start to say, with people being relatively similar, the people with breast cancer or not, what were the small differences? Mm. So it's the perfect population to do those kind of genetic studies.
It's really
fascinating. And so it's exciting with the flat world, right, with the notion that we're all connected, that research in Iceland helps us, and something here may help Nigeria. And I think we really are a global community with regard to cancer. You know, people have said cancer is bipartisan. Well, cancer is also global.
Really, really fascinating. This is a fascinating discussion. I hope that people who download this podcast will take to heart some of the things that you said, because it does sound optimistic, but it's important, as you stated throughout this discussion, that people, early detection is the key, right?
I mean, early detection and be aware of things. You know, the beauty of the internet is the great equalizer. So if you have cancer, read about things, learn, and have that discussion with your doctor. Doctors don't make decisions alone. This is a joint discussion with the doctor and you of what's to do.
Dr. David Agus, thank you very, very much. You've been listening to this episode of the CBS This Morning podcast. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Agus or for any of us here at CBS This Morning, please send us an email at ctmpodcast@cbsnews.com. ctmpodcast@cbsnews.com.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.